Welcome to the server and thanks for joining us. And congratulations on releasing Gamma Wolves.
Thanks. It's been a journey. I think I finished the manuscript in January or February. I think the end of January of 2019 it was done, and it was about 2 years to publication. It was spo the original release date for it was actually at Adepticon this past year, and so it's about 8 months late from where it was going to come out because of COVID, and we had to change artists at one point and a couple other things. So it's been a process getting it out. I had the idea at Adepticon 2017, and then I pitched it 2018, got it done 2019, and then now it's going to come out in 2020, which is pretty cool. I'm not quite as long a development cycle as I had for Last Days, where I wrote it in 2009 and it came out in 2017 or 18. I can't remember. 2018 maybe is when Last Days came out, but still, the writing to publication time. If I don't get something writing Gamma Wolves, it's because I've forgotten what I wrote. It's so funny. Sometimes the books show up and I'm like, who wrote this? Like, what even is this?
But the main difference, one of the main differences is that Osprey been part of this for the entire time, right? I mean, you pitched Gamma Wolf to, and Last Days you wrote for yourself.
Yes, Last Days I wrote for myself and then rewrote for I actually drastically rewrote Last Days. The 2009 version of Last Days is, except for like the core mechanics, which are pretty similar, the faction and the group building and the refuges just didn't exist. Like it was more like a traditional, because I don't like I knew war games, so I wrote factions, you know what I mean? So instead of having like the ability to take archetypes, the whole faction was an archetype. So like there was a faction built around cops, there was a faction built around road gangs, there was a faction built around just like regular everyday survivors, and we played a lot of that. And that was mostly just because that was mostly built around the models we had, the model collections we had, where we had like foundry miniatures and stuff, where like if you had street violence miniatures, you had like a gang of street violence miniatures. And so I built the game out around from the models, and then realized after playing it a whole bunch and then sitting back and looking at it to rewrite it, it didn't feel like a zombie movie. It felt like a war game that had zombies in it. And so when it came time to redo that one, I pulled all the pieces apart and threw a bunch of it away because I wasn't happy with where it was going.
It ended up being a good game. In the end of Gamma Wolves, and it's slowly getting into people's hands now. I don't know if, Northstar has started shipping it, and Amazon is always eager to pull the trigger on releasing games. At the end of Gamma Wolves, you're writing, you were wondering if you had another war game in you, and could you do a war game that was not about soldiers? Is that how it started? Is that the
Yes,
motivation?
that's usually what happens for me, is that I come up with like a I'm a problem so like a, I'm a puzzle guy. I love puzzles. I love like pulling things apart and problem solving. And so very often when I start a project, it kicks off with that. It kicks off with either I see a hole where there might not be a thing for me to enjoy my toy soldiers with, or I see like a problem set that I want to try and like tackle. And so for me, that was a big part of Gamma Wolves. It was how do you make a game that feels like that 30 to 40 seconds of every Robotech episode or every like Gundam episode where the robots actually fight, and it isn't just like melodrama of people like sitting in cockpits and feeling sad, which seems to be what sadly every giant robot movie devolves into, is some type of melodrama where people feel bad for themselves. And it's like,
Yeah,
just fight the
pretty much.
robots, just fight the fucking robots. I wanted that to be the point of the game and not the sad melodrama.
That's a game that's been missing, because I've seen on your Facebook or Instagram, whatever, that currently you're posting a lot of BattleTech mechs.
BattleTech is actually an armor game. If you play BattleTech back in the day, and I shouldn't misrepresent my knowledge of BattleTech. I have played BattleTech. I played other people's copies of BattleTech. I can never say that I was a BattleTech player though, because it was always me being roped into like being the other guy's target. You know what I mean? Where like someone's painted a huge BattleTech collection, they're like, come on, just play BattleTech with me for 5 minutes, and I'm like, oh, I hate math. And then I play BattleTech for a night, and I'm reminded why I didn't like BattleTech. BattleTech has more in common with like those old Avon Hill strategy games, where it's resource management and chunks of armor flying off people. So it's more like the Battle of Kursk, where like 500 tanks are fighting all at the same time, and you're more these huge plodding things clanging towards each other, having armor blown off them until one side falls apart. It isn't as balletic as it is in those like giant robot movies where there's strafing and maneuvering and things are flying around and moving really fast. And so I played Dreampod 9's Heavy Gear because it was a lot more like that. The game worked in a much more like movement oriented sort of way, where you were changed very drastically over the course of a turn, and it wasn't just like these kind of like plodding, you know, lumps of armor sort of like slogging away at each other until one side heated up too much and fell apart or shut down or whatever.
So
had all this armor blown off and fell over.
I've never played BattleTech, but from what you're describing there, you're describing Gamma Wolves to me, because armor is getting blown off, things are overheating, and you have to plan your movement with the mechanics.
There's a lot more movement in Gamma Wolves, though. That's the difference. Is if you've ever played the hex-based BattleTech, BattleTech is a game of very precise movement, but very limited movement. Stuff doesn't move around as fast. So like it's more like walls advancing towards each other. I think the difference is that in BattleTech, one of the big sort of like appreciable things is that it's immovable objects and unstoppable forces. So like you don't count in seconds, you count over the course of a whole turn. So for instance, in BattleTech, when you do damage to something, the person with initiative actually goes second because all damage doesn't get applied until the end of the turn. So the only tactical insight you really have is going first and going second and making a decision before your opponent, because nothing can ever be sort of like strategically removed from having an impact on a turn, because all the damage happens in a wave at the resolution of the end of the turn. Okay. And then all the armor comes flying off at the same time. And so it sounds like apples to apples, but like one of the big things in Gamma Wolves is you can actually react to movement with snap fire, and you can react to the gunnery phase with evasion. And so you can both move in the gunnery phase and shoot in the maneuvering phase, which you can't really do in BattleTech. Hang on 1 second. Sorry, guys. I gotta mute this for 2 seconds while talk to my son.
Yeah, sure.
What's up, buddy?
Can Rich ask?
So, a quick pause here. That's one of the charms of doing a talk like this. We all have kids running around.
I'm back. Sorry, he needed me write the word chest so he could search in Minecraft for a chest.
Sure.
that was literally the problem that I was just solving. But everyone listening knows that was a crisis that couldn't wait for Dad to be on his call. I had to write EST because his sister did the ch part of the word.
Danish Minecraft, anyway. And that's one of the few games that's actually translated into Danish, and so it's a lot easier to find stuff in Danish because for my kid at least.
I was in the middle of a very long-winded explanation as to why I wasn't writing BattleTech, but I wanted to write a mech combat game where stuff didn't happen in big waves and you had more of an impact on the game turn. So because both things are incorporated into either phase, the gunnery phase and the maneuvering phase, both incorporate aspects of each other. There's more of like an action, a push-pull, like an action-reaction.
Yeah.
And when you're managing your reactors, you're also managing your ability to stay on the table and also your pilot endurance is being managed as well, because if you want to evade or you want to snap fire, you're also draining that resource. And yeah, so
I really like that resource part of Gamma Wolves, where you have to consider you can move a lot, put stress on your reactor, you can fire a lot, put stress on the reactor and the pilot, and that whole war clock thing that's winding down. The more you do, the quicker you have to leave the battlefield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that was, to me, that was an important part of putting in weapons that manage that sort of affect the reactor as well, and causing there to be sort of a penalty to either camping behind cover and just firing your big weapons. That's another part of why I decided that cover wasn't actually a negative modifier to the active player, but being in the open was a positive modifier. You want to reward maneuvering and penalize camping, right? So like a lot of games will look at cover as being like a negative mod stack that you can choose to have or not have. The assumption in Gamma Wolves is everyone's always trying to avoid being shot and staying out of the way. But being exposed and being in the open is a bonus to the active player. And so the person in control of whether or not they get the bonus becomes the active player maneuvering and taking a risk versus the inactive player sitting down. So you don't want to really reward inactivity as a game designer. It's just a boring mechanic, and it makes for boring games, versus like sort of rewarding the active player maneuvering to a better position. So like getting to a flank, getting to a rear, or getting a model that's exposed. And so it's a very like all or nothing mechanic, but it's also not going to reward like just unfun sort of like game behavior.
It's an interesting thought to have in the design, because I know that's one of the things that Joseph McCullough has been struggling with on Star Saga. How mm-hmm. was he going to prevent, now that everybody can shoot, that you would just stay in cover, shoot up the other guys, and then claim all the treasure?
Mm-hmm.
So
how do you make it boring? Well, I mean, that was his worst nightmare warband. He just took the all-archer warband. It's one of the reasons he relegated them to being specialists, right? So you can only have four. Because the all-archer warband was way too good for what
and
it did.
They fought like...
And boring as hell, yeah. They fought like thugs. And most people... The other half of that is you're really relying on your and I'm going to use this in air quotes, but customers, right? The people buying your game and playing it. Having a terrain selection that either prevents that from happening or discourages from happening, it's not really realistic. Not everybody's got a huge, like... ruin spire train. A lot of people are just playing with books on a table, you know what I mean, and toilet paper rolls to be towers. So you can't just expect that someone's going to have this amazing train collection that makes it so that is a boring warband to play. You have to assume that people are going to even stumble into that warband by accident, just going like, well, I've got these 12 Bretonian archer models, that's what I use my warband.
Yeah, so boring. You know, I would never play people like that.
Well, yeah, but they're a segment. I have a sort of like a get along sort of mentality with all kind of classes of players. I myself might not have that as my hobby, you know what I mean? But I think a big part of the success of Frostgrave was that there was a lot of people that played it that were those guys that had some old cookie tin full of D&D minis in a closet somewhere, and all of a sudden had this cool game to try it. And so they weren't really specifically collecting things for Frostgrave, but they looked at Frostgrave and went, sure, yeah, I'll give that a go. I'll find my old Ral Partha D&D minis from the 80s and throw them on the table and try it out. I saw a lot of that actually locally. There was a lot of our guys in our local Osprey Facebook group that were posting pictures of their Frostgrave games, and it was like a throwback, like mishmash collection of models from everything from like old board games to old D&D sets to whatever, and they're all on different size bases and all different variations of paint. So it's like, cool, like awesome, good for you for trying this out.
That's my bestiary as well, and that's one of my problem with Gamma Wolf, because I don't really have anything that can cover those big frames because they mm-hmm. are huge. I mean,
yeah,
I've just took out some CDs, so I've shrunk all the base sizes because a CD is cheap and I have a lot of them. But I don't have a robot that can fill that stuff out.
Hit the toy store. See what they got down at the dollar store.
Yeah,
That's it. Thrift stores. They start bolting stuff onto it. That was the idea behind Gamma Wolves. I was flipping through two things. One was, I was sitting down. I was chatting with Mike Hutchinson from Gaslands just about that. My theories about Gaslands, because Osprey was very surprised by how well it did, and sort of like the reaction and stuff to it. And I have a sort of like industry theory about the DNA of like people who are hobby gamers who like a game, they have to prepare the materials for themselves and have like that hobby sort of like gene. If you mix it with another interest, like if you mix it with sports, you get the Blood Bowl fan who's been keeping that game alive for like 30 years without any support from the company that makes it. You know what I mean? Where you have these absolutely diehard fantasy football fans that did not need any encouragement to just keep playing the game for three decades.
That's a great game.
It's that idea. And then you mix it with cars. So the people that are car fans and have that like calendar in the back of the wall of the garage, and they've been perpetually fixing up a Ford Falcon or something like that. That those guys have that second level of like mania that creates these like uber hobbyists that jump on things. And I think he accidentally unlocked that. Like he was excited about, you know, the movie side of it. He's like, he's an artistic guy, and he likes the Mad Max movies and the car movies and the Dark Future stuff and the Death Race stuff.
So,
but then
having this
tapped into that hobby thing,
having that theory and looking at how well Gaslands did with that perspective, have you been thinking those thoughts when
yes.
doing Gamma Wolves.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the idea, was that there's a whole layer of people out there that love mecha modeling. And I already knew about them because I have friends that do it. I have friends that build Gundams. I have friends that build these incredibly beautiful resin kits from Japan, like the machining, the Mac stuff, the Machine and Krieger stuff. And they're just, they love building these bespoke, you know, custom giant robot miniatures. And it's, and but there's no end state to it, right? There's no like, and now we play a game. There's no like activity after building and painting them. The activity is just building and painting them. And so my idea was, well, what if I gave you a game to play with these things? You know what I mean? And I made it so that the base size didn't matter and you could just plunk it down on a base and play a game. And what would that unlock for that community as well? Like Gaslands did for people that didn't paint model cars. Because there was already a huge community of people that repainted Hot Wheels cars. And I don't even know if you realize that. Like Gaslands didn't make that happen.
Gaslands tapped
into that. You know what I mean? If you go to like Hot Wheel Maniacs, there's like, I don't know, something insane, like hundreds of thousands of people in a group just like repainting Hot Wheels cars. Huge hobby, exactly. So that was my idea. Was like, well, what other thing is like that that doesn't have a sort of like end goal? So what can I do to fill that in?
So when you mentioned, you know, Japan and mechs and Gundam kits and these intricate modeling kits, none of those are post-apocalypse.
No.
They're all pure sci-fi.
No, that's not true at all. That's not true at all. If you look at Gundam, I don't know how much you know about Gundam, but like
nothing.
Most of Gundam sci-fi. Is actually post-apocalyptic. No, it's mostly post-apocalyptic. But you have to understand that their version of post-apocalyptic isn't that the technology has decayed somehow.
All right,
it's just that the Earth is
okay.
Totally
the Earth is
destroyed.
Blown up, but
yeah,
the,
exactly
because that's perhaps then what's skipped my mind. Reading Gamma Wolves, because when I read post-apocalypse, that's...
You think Mad Max.
And scrap materials and scrap robots, and those are going to be cool, and I can build those cheap.
And you can do that, and you can 100% do that, too. Like, that's the idea, is Gamma Wolves didn't need to be that specific, right? The world building is a MacGuffin for why are people not able to go outside and have to live inside giant robots. And the post-apocalyptic thing, the end of the world thing, is just as relevant. There's tons and tons of the literature. Like, if you can't, I think the difference is you're coming at this from the sort of like your wargaming experience side, where you already play things like This Is Not a Test.
Yeah.
You know, those miniature games where there's a very clearly defined, like, we're wearing bowler hats and using like made up pipe guns kind of post-apocalypse versus like, I look at that post-apocalypse in the sci-fi world and a lot of the like, a lot of like the key giant robot science fiction is where the giant robots are the thing that we use to fight wars now, because we literally can't have infantry go outside, right? Or like the Matrix, like if you've ever watched the Animatrix, where like they're fighting the robots at the end, they're all wearing these powered suits because like they can't go outside anymore because they blocked the sun and like the Earth is all crusted over and all that stuff.
I haven't had that thought when reading it.
Mm-hmm.
That might just be me, or or does Gamma Wolves require more from the reader?
I don't think so. I think it's just open ended enough that you take into it what your ideas already are. I mean, I won't know until it comes out, right? What people start doing, but there's already a lot of people in that Facebook group
that have been making
giant robots.
Yes,
and that was just based on the playtest group, right? The playtest group was the people that were doing all that stuff. Before the game even came out, I think it was like 1,200. I haven't even looked. It was like 1,200 people or 400 people or something like that in the group. Yeah.
A lot of activity. It's really impressive.
And I think that was the encouraging thing for me when I started writing it, was thinking that yes, there is something there. There's a kernel of something there where there's some interest in. Oh, I already had all these Gundam kits, and the number of people that would post in the group when they found out that I was writing it, being like, I found these in my closet, and here's the four different Gundam kits I bought over the years because I thought this was cool, but I've never built one. Now I'm gonna build one. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want. That's what I'm trying to encourage here. You know what I mean? Is that try something out, do something new. Or do something new with things I already have.
You mentioned, so it's delayed, and COVID delayed a lot of stuff. But you mentioned that you had to switch the artist?
Yeah, we switched artists halfway through. It didn't work out with the original artist.
All right.
And we just switched over to a new artist. It wasn't anything other than like just a busy time thing.
Okay.
Also, I wrote a giant robot game right in the middle of there being this... huge giant robot RPG crowdfund for a game called Lancer, where all the giant robot artists got hired like at once to do like art for these like gajillion RPG books that all of a sudden needed to be illustrated. So I'm pretty sure it was just a bad timing thing. There was a bunch of like demand for people that could draw cool giant robots, and wires got switched, and there was like too much work to go around.
And you
it just pushed things back.
And you're happy with the results,
yeah, I love the
with
art.
The change.
Yeah, yeah, I love the art. Yeah, I love the art. I love the art because it's the there's two things that were important about it, that one of which I was a bit nervous about. The first one was that you never see the pilots, but that was a conscious decision.
Why?
It was the same as the conscious decision to do it in Gaslands. You never see the drivers in Gaslands for the most part either. The windows are always blacked out and stuff. One, it makes it accessible to everybody. Everybody can identify with piloting one of those giant robots, I think was the idea. If they don't see the pilots, anybody could be sitting inside that thing. And two, it puts the focus on the robots, right? Because the focus is on the robots. And so you think the robots are the feature, not the people. Now, I don't think that needs to be forever. I think that just for the initial book, that's a good idea. Because I was really excited to explore the places more, but I think I'm going to do that in like the follow-ups to it if I do end up writing a bunch of additional material. Like I want to do some features on some of the different arcologies, like do like a supplement for each of the arcologies, and to see the people inside the arcology I think is powerful. So like when those come out, see like what life is like there. And the same for the Ronin and the Free Stations, do like a little Ronin supplement that has some like key Free Stations like Machu Picchu and Alert and stuff like that, where there's these places that you see what the culture is like. I think there's some appetite for that, but I also didn't want to do too much of that, because again, then that starts to populate what people think they should be using for models or what the game should look like. And I don't want to limit what people want to do for giant robots. Like I want there to be just as many junky giant robots that you make as the big smooth Gundam giant robots too, right? I think that one of the dangers of filling in too much information is you don't let people's imaginations expand into an idea.
There's an
element of that. I think that Games Workshop started to run that risk a little while ago with things like the Horus Heresy, where the Horus Heresy was this amazing mythology. Now that you know too much about it, it's kind of like it makes it so that you almost get like that historical gamer mindset going into it, like, oh, those unit markings aren't right for that cohort of the Ultramarines Legion or what, you know what I mean? Like, where you're like, oh god, it's like Napoleonics. I didn't get the gray right.
Pretty bad for the mythology that we now know what happened to Alpharius, because it was just better that we didn't.
It also inspires people to the joy of the hobby, of the miniature world gaming hobby, is that you paint in your own little corner of a universe, right? No matter what it is, if you're whatever you're making, you are creating your own little sort of mythology for yourself. And I think that's what makes lifelong hobbyists, is that you're not copying someone else's idea onto paper. And I think that might make it more accessible, but people who are really sort of like the people that are enriched, I think, by a hobby like this, are the ones that kind of their imagination creates their own little bubble inside that universe. And so you don't want to draw the edges of the sandbox too close together, because it just gives people less place to play.
I got you. But yeah, for me personally, I'm looking forward to, if it's going to be Blaster or an official expansion, seeing those pictures or descriptions of the crew or the arcologies, because that wouldn't lock the sandbox for me. But perhaps I'm looking, because the focus on the game and the mechanics for doing mech combat, they seem pretty solid. I think it's going to be a good game. I can't identify with a robot. I identify with the guy on the inside and his motivations for being in the waste. So I'm looking forward to if you go into that at some point.
And that's the plan. Like that's what I want to do. I want to flesh that out more, because the arcologies all have their archetypes right now. But like, what motivates a pilot from the, you know, the bird, who is this like, he's this like gene crafted post human that has been designed to like operate there, but he doesn't really know anything about the wider world. He doesn't know the history of the planet, or that he's been made for a purpose, and he thinks he's this like noble creation where he might just be expendable, because he doesn't even know he switches off in 20 years. His body just shuts down and switches off in 20 years. So, like, what is life like for that guy?
I read those poor guys as they're poor souls.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and, like, and then like, what do you do for the Ronin where they, you know, maybe one of your Ronin is one of those guys that's basically cut loose and been freed. He's a fugitive, and you know, the other brute forces are always on the lookout for him. And how can you incorporate that idea of like, maybe you're on the run, maybe you're sort of like outlaws or whatever. There's a lot of like room to build fun campaign mechanics and stuff into that. And then I have a couple of, one of the things I definitely want to do, because this was written pre-COVID, right, was I want to do some solo rules for it. And I think that's going to be a publication I probably just do on my own, because I don't know how quickly it would come out through Osprey. So I think I'll probably just do that as a self-published thing, probably not through Blaster, but probably just in conjunction with the guys from Blaster, maybe just doing the layout and stuff.
Are you going to play Gamma Wolves?
And stuff. Yeah, for sure I'm going to play Gamma Wolves. I'm just finishing recording the Let's Play right now, actually. It'll come out next week. There'll be a Let's Play on just the general core mechanics and stuff. And I'm going to do a book flip through, not a review, because obviously I'm not going to review my own book, but I'll do an overview of like the game and flipping through how it works next weekend as well on my channel, so people can see the book and see the general sort of like core mechanics and have like an explanation from the author. And it's good for me too, because I can remember how my game works, because you know, it's been a year since I played it.
Yeah, and that's the point, because so if you're some people, when you put a lot of work into it, you know, spend an entire day preparing dinner and you don't have an appetite when you get to it, or spend a lot of time working on a game or music. When it's done, it's done, and you want to do something else.
That's everything I think to do with publishing too, though, right? Because you put a lot of work into something, you got to get just right, and then you still have to wait a whole bunch of time for the mechanics of something to get like printed and put out into the world. And so that's something I'm kind of used to, just because I've worked in the industry for so long. I understand that everything you see coming out today was made a year ago at least. Yeah. Doesn't matter what company it is, it's all been designed. It should be, hopefully, if it's going to be a good product. Otherwise, you're getting really close to the printing date and things slip through with like big typos or big mistakes or big holes or something like that.
Yeah, some companies will do that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, let's not get into to that part. Anything else you want to tell about your new game? Gamma Wolf is out. Is it officially released now?
26th, I think, is the date it comes out.
All right.
Yeah, 26th. But I mean, there's lots of copies floating around, I'm pretty sure. Like you said, as soon as it shows up in the Amazon warehouse, they usually ship it. So it's it's out of the bag at this point. I'm not really sure. I think just if you ever wanted to build a giant robot or two, this is probably the game for you. I mean, the minimum, it's basically 3 to 6 giant robots based on the training levels that you pick for your crew and the type of crew you pick. But if you're just excited to build one, or you have a bunch of things on the shelf, give it a go, because it's a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it. I'm enjoying playing my own game, and that's usually a pretty good sign that it's something that that I'm interested in writing more for too, right? If I didn't enjoy playing it and I didn't think it was going to be fun and I wasn't excited to build some models for it, then it would probably be like a one and done. It would be a one and done, but I'm having a good time with it. So
that's good.
To write more stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Looking forward to checking out the Let's Play videos for it. Get a better grip of the mechanics.
You can see the studio models actually like moving around and shooting each other and stuff, which would be fun. It's a fun like bunch of resource management, trying to decide where you want to be when you start shooting, and then once you realize that even when you start shooting, stuff can still move. I think that's where the game becomes really interesting, because you can still continue to evade once you're done. Like, things aren't stuck in place ever, and if you save your resources, then you can move at the right time and really pull some sneaky stuff on your opponent.
Looking forward to it. And speaking of your channel or your main work as well, let's make that a bridge to Tom, who's prepared a lot of questions for
about Guerrilla Minis.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like butter.
Yeah. I'll try not to be all fanboyish here, but I've been watching Ash since he started. And but for those who haven't, where did it all start? The GMG channel or Guerrilla Miniature Games YouTube channel? That's a mouthful.
Just say GMG. It's way easier.
Yeah,
I say GMG. I don't even know why. The worst is I have to type my email address into things, and I'm like, oh, God, why? Why didn't I just say GMG Ash at gmail.com? What was wrong with me?
I'm glad you changed the Facebook address, because I had to type it up at some point. I can't remember when. I was like, how the hell do you spell this? It's not gorilla. It's
I should never be hired to do any marketing, because I make terrible decisions.
But how did it all start, Dinesh? If you can sort of give a quick rundown of.
Sure. Yeah. It started in 2014, I moved back to Canada. I was the North American retail sales director for Games Workshop. I was living in Memphis, Tennessee, at our shipping and distribution hub for North America there, and flying all over North America visiting my shops. And I left that job after my daughter was born, because I was traveling a ton. And when my work permit was up, I came back to the Niagara region. And there's another YouTube channel, which is pretty big around here, called Mini Wargaming, who I had no idea existed, but my daughter's mother is from this region, so we ended up landing here initially. And I was painting Infinity miniatures at the time. So I ended up answering just a Facebook post saying, like, hey, come play Infinity. And I was like, okay, I'll come play Infinity. So I painted up some Infinity models and went and played a game with Matthew from Mini Wargaming. And was like, I had no idea I was going to be on camera. Like, just showed up being like, this is a weird gaming store. Like, where am I? I ended up getting hired a couple weeks later. And I spent about 8 months there until my son was born. I'm just recording games. And when I left, because my son was born, I was staying home at the time. Their mother was focusing on her career at that time, and I was kind of just making up a job. I did a crowdfund for just a camera to keep recording games, because I thought it was fun. It was a fun thing to do, and I registered the YouTube channel on January 1st, I think, 2015. Mm-hmm. So like 8 months left for Mini Wargaming, yeah. And then was just recording games, and I did the crowdfund for a camera for Mini Wargaming, and it blew up. And people were like, well, you've got like 10 times the money that you need for the camera. What are you going to do now? And I was like, I guess I'll go bake the studio. And so I just went and found some office space and paid some money to build a gaming table and buy some gaming mats and started recording. And I just ended up with my own little studio space. And that's 5 years ago now. And yeah, we've been there for 5 years, just recording games and doing like, it turned into like a pro bono marketing thing for small independent publishers and independent like widget makers, and just to sort of like, hey, I'm a guy who's been in the industry for a long time, and I'm good at talking about these things because I know a lot about not just the hobby side of it as a customer, because I am a customer, but I'm also a person who's made, shipped, sold, and developed games, you know, on the other side of it. Like, I worked since 2001 for Games Workshop, so I worked for 14 years for Games Workshop.
Yeah.
In all different forms and functions. I was a retail kid when I was in art school, and I just worked my way up till I was a sales director, right? So like, I had a bunch of like, I guess, left side, right side knowledge of the industry, and people seem to just kind of value that. And that's where the YouTube channel came from. And I've got relationships with all kinds of like all my lots of great friends still at Games Workshop, and people who are ex Games Workshop and have their own companies now, and friends of Privateer Press and Corpus Belli, and you know, all these wonderful industry titles that have been produced over like the last like 5 or 6 years. Really, it's interesting because I think I picked a good, I got lucky. There's that old saying, like, lucky best and first. Part of it was lucky in that the industry went through a really big growth period, I think from 2015 to now.
Oh yeah.
For a bunch of reasons, but like, it, one was just that direction change at Workshop, I think, them leaning into social media a lot more and leaning into nostalgia and old style games, things like their Forge World Division doing redoing Necromunda and Blood Bowl, and things like new things like Shadespire. And then even Privateer Press doing kind of the same thing with like Riot Quest and stuff. Like, there's a lot of like, there's been a lot of sort of like, hey, we realize that our customers got older and aren't just looking to play the next tournament game over and over again, and want like our customers are turning those people that go to restaurants and want to do nothing but order appetizers.
Yep.
Right. They don't want to eat a giant, huge steak dinner every single night. They want to go sometimes and just pick up their food and be like entertained by it and watch a, you know, a sports game on TV or whatever.
Tapas has been a huge thing here in Denmark as well.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. For the same reason.
Exactly. But that's exactly it, right? Like, you don't have time as a grown person, and let's not kid around, the grown people are where the money is. Like, that's a smart business decision too. You have a limited amount. You still have the same amount of fun money you probably had when you're in your 20s and you could build a giant army and play a 3-hour war game, but you have a limited amount of time, so you want the satisfaction from that amount of time to be greater. If I can paint 10 models and have just as much fun as if I played a game with 100 models, then give me more things to do with 10 models, right? And that's where I think the industry has leaned into in the last little while, and you've seen a lot of success from things where the time, the we used to call it a Games Workshop, the Christmas morning test, which is from the time the wrapping's torn off to the time you're playing games, what is the amount of time between that and fun?
Yeah.
Right? And so there's, and I think the ultimate expression for that in 2015 was X-Wing.
Yeah, totally.
Right. I mean, so if you that's it. So open and play, right? So X-Wing was like lightning in a bottle. It just completely took game stores by storm. There, people were begging to get more copies of it because you could just rip the packaging off and go. And you actually saw that with the Song of Ice and Fire when it first came off, right? You just punch tokens and play. It was ready to go pretty much out of the box. People have tried to emulate that since then. And I think it goes too far sometimes in one direction, and the game is maybe too light, you know what I mean? And then you get like a Rune Wars or something like that, or too far in the other direction, and the game is too dense, and people are sort of like not able to play that either.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
What do you need, buddy? Sorry, I got my son. You need help putting your armor on your armor stand? How do you do that? I don't know what I do. What did I do? I don't know. We'll fix it then. 1 second, guys. Sorry.
Yeah.
And then Dad broke the armor piece.
Yeah. Typical. Typical Dad.
No, I fixed it. I broke it and then I put it back on. I fixed it.
Okay.
He's using the iOS one. So like, if you touch it once, it breaks it. If you hold your finger down, it puts the armor down. And he was just stabbing the screen with his finger and crushing it over and over again. Because my son is just a tiny version of myself and has no patience.
Yeah.
It was like that scene from Zoolander where it's like the files are in the computer and they're just smashing the computer to try and find it. but yeah, no, I think that's a part of my success too, is that I've had the luxury of this big growth time in the industry where people who are my age have had a rekindled interest in war games.
So you're sort of riding the wave just as it started, basically.
I think I'm just and I'm exactly the right age with exactly the right experience and background as my audience. If I look at my YouTube metrics, it's really interesting because I don't have a lot of viewers that are outside my own age bracket. Like, I think something like 70 or 80% of my audience is between 25 and 55. Right. So they're right in that, like, not a kid playing tournament games, but not like the historical guy with like a 2-foot long beard. But, I mean, they're that we grew up, we watched Ghostbusters, we watched Transformers, we watched Star Wars, like we watched a lot of the same stuff. And so I have stuff in common with my audience. And I think that's been a lucky break for me.
Oh yeah, totally. But seeing as you're every day, right? Except Sundays, sort of. No, that's what.
Well, today. So usually. Well, Sundays was the podcast, was Let's Talk, and I can't record anymore. So Witches and Wonders is based usually on what shows up. So I do actually have a Witches and Wonders this week, but I'm talking to you guys instead of filming it right now.
Okay.
I'll put it up later. It'll be a thing I film tonight at some point.
Okay.
And put it up next week.
But I was sort of wondering, how do you keep finding joy in the hobby? I mean, it's seeing as you've turned your hobby into your work, I'm guessing, at the very least, it's a sort of a 9-to-5 gig for you now.
It is a 9-to-5, yeah.
Yeah. How do you keep finding joy? And I know, for the listeners, I know that you have said many times that you're painting offline. Mm-hmm. So that's for you. So I know that that's sort of where. But how about the gaming part? Do you still find it? Still get the joy from playing games, if you know what
I mean? Yes, I do. And usually the joy for me is the preparing to play a game. It's actually the The most fun I have is when I try a new game from the point of embarking and finding the right models, making the right terrain, through that like shared experience of like playing with that person that's also getting ready to do that. That's how we got those great series like This Is Not a Test and the original Frostgrave series and stuff like that, where me and my like-minded friends will get together and have an idea, and it's that getting that to take shape in front of us is like where I get the joy from the hobby, you know what I mean? And I like discovering new games and new editions. Like the initial wrapping my head around a game is probably my favorite part. And that's a real conscious thing for me. If you ever want to read, I actually it's funny because I reread this to my son the other day. If you ever want to read exactly how I do it, my section in Dave Taylor's book Armies, Legions, and Hordes talks about that. I have a whole section in that book about old White Dwarf article that Jervis Johnson wrote called The Hobby Pie, and it's just like it's some pop psychology basically about knowing what you enjoy in the hobby and trying to maximize that part while minimizing the things that you find kind of like the doldrums. You'll take more joy in the hobby. I wrote a really good article in that book actually about that stuff, but it basically boils down to knowing what you like the most and spending the time you want on that stuff. And that's why I keep that painting stuff for myself, because I really enjoy painting miniatures as like a relaxation thing. I like sitting on my couch. I have this like black leather ottoman that I'm sitting in front of right now. And it's like a storage one, like the top flips up, and it's just got like all my paints in it and like a little green cutting mat that I paint on. And then I have a arm light, an aught light that just sits sort of like folded away in the corner. And I actually just paint in my living room. Like I paint in front of the TV. I'll put like a series on. I'm watching The Purge on Amazon Prime right now. It's my current painting thing that I'm watching. But like I'll just put like a TV show on after the kids go to bed, and I'll sit for like 3 or 4 hours a night and paint. And that's how I paint all the miniatures I paint too, right? Like I look forward to doing that. It's kind of like part of my nightly ritual. I make my cup of tea. I make a cup of tea and I'll sit down and I'll do that painting. And so that's a big part of it, because I think that most people, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I just have these skills that I've developed over 30 years of wargaming that most people don't have, right? Like not everyone can paint 1,000 miniatures in a year.
No.
and almost like while they're asleep, you know what I mean? Like I'm barely paying attention to my miniatures. I'm just painting and watching TV. Like I get in the zone.
Yeah.
But that's probably what makes that 7 day week schedule, 7 days a week schedule possible, is that I'm able to try lots of new games and play lots of new games and pivot into new games and just still enjoy it, because I'm getting ready to do something new pretty much every week. Like this week I'm getting ready to play Armada by Mantic Games, and I'm getting ready to play Battletech. You saw me getting ready last week to play Battletech. There's a couple other new games that are, I shouldn't really talk about probably, that are like behind the door still, that I'm kind of starting to get ready to play. I got a whole bunch of stuff for Warcaster from Privateer Press I got to paint, that I'm getting ready to play. Like just, yeah, there's always something new. Like that's the great thing about the industry right now, is that it's growing and there's lots of little things, but none of them take like a million years to play. So it's not like to paint like my cool robots for Bot Wars, you know what I mean? It was like a day and a half of painting. But Mike and I are really enjoying playing like a cool 80s cartoon game. You know, like and that changes it up for me. It's not just, I could not be the guy who just played a 40K game every week. Right? Like I would die like playing 40K games all the time. And I'd probably be way more successful as a YouTube channel if I did nothing but post 40K games, because those still get the biggest metrics of anything I post, but I would hate it. And that's the benefit I think I have of having, at this point, cultivated the right audience, not a big audience. You know what I mean? My audience is the right audience for me. So it doesn't have to be the biggest audience in the world, because I'm not for everybody. But I think what happens is eventually everyone out there who's playing like the sort of mass market games will age into being my audience. I'm kind of looking at it as like a long game, where eventually people get bored with doing the same thing all the time and they start to look for different things. And I'll be there when that happens. I've got that right mentality of like, I don't need to be the biggest. I'm more interested in having people that have the same sort of shared hobby vision as me, as my viewers.
But in that sort of vein, I mean, you're kind of the online godfather of indie games at this point, at the very least in the YouTube realm. How indie can a game be before you are sort of hesitant to get it on your channel? I mean, I know that you're reluctant to go for anything Kickstarter-y. It has to be at least published in some form.
It has to be done. It has to be done.
Yeah. Okay.
And mostly it also, if you're trying to make your game successful, it has to be done in a way that I'm actually able to help you.
Mm.
Right. Like one of my problems that I have very often communicating that is that people are like, well, I have this great idea and can you play a game on your channel? And I'd really like to get more interested in it. It's like, well, I can do all those things, but at the same time, that doesn't help you at all. Like that doesn't actually help you to be more successful as a game designer. Like the thing that would help you right now is if you did that, is if you went out and put your game in front of people and tried it. Like if your game doesn't work and is broken, all me recording one of your games is going to do is make it look like you made a terrible game.
Like
you get one shot at this. And also if you're actually planning on doing this and making some money, it's got to be ready for sale. Right? Mm. Like I can do this, but you really only get one kick at the can at it. And if it's not ready, it's not ready. So I'm always willing to look at stuff. Like people can send me stuff and I'll look at it. And I have a huge backlog of things I'd like to get time to look at that honestly, like there's never going to be enough hours in the day for me to look at everybody's game forever.
A quick glance at Wargame Vault and you can see how many titles
those are the top 10% that actually get to that stage too. Think about how many are sitting on a hard drive or a thumb drive somewhere as a document, not even close to that stage, right? Like if they've got art and a cover and an ISBN and they made it on Wargames Vault, that's 90% more finished than most of the stuff I would get sent. Right? There's a real kind of hard conversation sometimes you have to have where it's, and I've had this conversation a lot of times actually at gaming conventions where people are like, how can I do what you do? Like, how can I become a game designer? I'm like, well, how many games have you written? And they go, well, I haven't written a game yet. I'm like, then you're not going to be a game designer. Like the difference between you and me is I was writing miniature games because I wanted to write miniature games. If you're going to be a game designer, you should already be doing it. Right? Like, it's like being an artist. Like, how do I become an artist? Well, do you draw? Well, no, I don't draw, but I want to become an artist. Ooh, then you're not an artist. Like, sorry. But to become these things, you don't do it because you like the idea of doing it. You do it because you can't not do it.
Mm,
yeah. Right? Like, most people that are successful in this realm, they have a folder of abandoned projects that's 10 miles deep that are just the ideas that they've had over time, right? Like, you don't become a game designer. You can't not write games or you can't not draw. Like to me, that's the difference. That's a hard conversation to have with people. But I think it's the same conversation that musicians have with each other, that anybody who likes the idea of doing something that approaches a person that's doing it ends up needing to have. And maybe that person isn't as big an asshole as I am and will actually say that to somebody. But I'd rather hear that, you know what I mean? If I was that young person, than not hear it and, you know, like wait for my opportunity to come along. You know what I mean? Mm. You can't wait for opportunity to come along. You just make it. Like you just make things happen and you do it until it works. That's honestly, if anyone's ever asked me how GMG happened, it was just, well, you just do things until it happens. That's it. I just kept saying yes and okay and yeah, let's try it until this is where I am now, right? Like there isn't one Willy Wonka golden ticket that's going to get you there. It's just doing it until it's working.
Yeah, there's not a single trajectory to get there. It's just you happen. The winding road sort of leads you there, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The path not taken stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And just start. Like, it's that, I know it's that shitty Shia LaBeouf meme of like, just do it.
Yeah.
Like, that's not, he's not wrong. It's a terrible meme. And I feel bad that that's what he's going to be remembered for when he's 80 years old. But that is literally the secret to success is you just do things and they're going to suck and they're going to be terrible. Like somewhere on my mom and dad's IBM 2 with its like yellow and black monochrome screen is the first war game I ever wrote when I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And it's just a crappy knockoff version of Space Hulk. But like at the same time, I started doing it when I was 8 or 9 years old. And my whole life I've written games for me and my friends to play. And eventually you get to the point where you show them to somebody else. And when you're brave enough to do that, then you're a game designer.
Yeah.
Right. When someone else plays something you've written voluntarily, then you're a game designer. That's how you get there. And it takes a lot of you sort through a lot of trash between now and then.
Mm.
And it's the same with being a YouTuber. Like that was the other thing is I've seen so many in the last like 10 years. I've seen so many people, or 5 years, sorry,
mm.
10 years. 10 years is on the games. The last 5 years doing the YouTube thing, people ask me, how can I be a successful YouTuber? I said, well, how many YouTube videos have you made? And it's the same. It's the same thing. Like you and well, but I want to make money doing it. It's like, well, you got to make something before people are going to pay you to do it. And yeah. If you haven't started making things yet, no one's going to pay you. So stop starting a Patreon before you start a YouTube channel.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, there's a million people that go through that. They're like, well, no one signed up for my Patreon, so I'm not going to start my YouTube channel. And it's like, what did you think was going to happen? Like, are you just Homer Simpson sitting being like, can I have some internet money now?
Yeah.
Like, everybody thought that Simpsons episode was real, and it's not. Like, sorry, Jesus.
Yeah, but I don't think it's sort of people sort of kid themselves into thinking, oh, I just need a Patreon and then everything will be fine. It's like, no, you need a product. That's still. The alpha and omega of anything is that you still need some content to show people.
You need to hobby. I've started that at YouTube and Twitter and stuff like that, and this podcast thing, but it's for me. I'm listening exactly, to you and talking to you because it's for me. Yeah. It's part of my hobby, and then I'll put it out there.
I think that's the one other thing I haven't talked about yet is people ask me why do I think that I've been successful in my content. I don't think that people realize that I'd be doing what I'm doing in the videos without there being a video anyway. All the video is just people coming along and watching me do it. But me and my friends are all just a bunch of idiots who stand around making terrible jokes and playing toy soldiers. And we'd be doing that no matter what. We would just be swearing a lot more and not being on camera if I was making a YouTube video, right? Like, we'd be doing it in my basement. That's the only difference as opposed to doing it in the studio, right? Like, it's... This isn't something that I'm doing for video. This is something I'm doing anyway, and the video is coming along. Yeah. And I think that's the big difference. Same with podcasting. Like, you hear people with successful podcasts, they just like hanging out with each other. Joe Rogan doesn't. He's not an interviewer. He's not a journalist. But he loves sitting around and drinking and talking to his friends. Yeah. And he's now one of the richest men. You know what I mean? Who's self-employed probably in the U.S. unincorporated rich people. Because that's what he does. He's really good at bringing people along and doing that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the missing ingredient that people don't see. They don't see the back half of that, which is the motivation. And the motivation is actually just to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Not to be doing it any certain way.
Yeah. But so sort of the sort of flip side to this is that you have become popular with your YouTube channel. And do you ever sort of have this sort of, felt a sort of pressure in regards to showcasing games on your channel? I mean, sort of making or breaking games, indie games especially?
That's hard, yeah.
Yeah.
Usually that's where I say yes or no, period. Where I'm like, it's not ready or not. Mm. And being clear at the beginning that there's no expectation I'm going to do anything with it. Mm. It's just, I just have to be honest with you and be like, I mean, you can send it if it's ready. Cool, I'll look at it. But there's no like guarantee that I'm going to be even have time to do something with it. I have a pile of unlooked at games.
Yeah,
at the studio right now that I just don't have time for right now. Like,
yeah, exactly. Okay.
And I might need an opponent for it. Like, it's not a single player game, so I can maybe do one video. But if there's like really like ingrained choice, doing it solo doesn't make a lot of sense. There's a lot of that, so it's just being transparent about it with the people making the games solves 99% of what you're talking about. And I don't feel any pressure to say good things or bad things. People have said that about my reviews, actually.
They don't feel
like reviews. They tend to feel more like features. And I think that's actually there's a slight misunderstanding between review and editorial. I tend not to editorialize about things. Mm. I do tend to review them sort of objectively. So I do an objective review. Here are the features of this, and if you like this, that might be a benefit, right? Mm. But I don't try and tell you what's good and bad. Because that's up to the viewer to determine. I'm not going to say I love or hate X or Y game, but I'm going to say it has this, it doesn't have that. Mm. And I think that makes them, that actually makes them stand up longer as a product. If you go back and look at my reviews, because they're not sort of inflamed by my opinion, and they're more an objective sort of overview of what something is and what something isn't.
Well, and then again, I mean, opinions change. I mean, I didn't care much for Age of Sigmar back in the day, but I do now, and then sort of not do anyway. I mean, it fluctuates all the time how I feel about that particular game. insert in the game name. I've just had that one in my mind. And that's also what I like about your reviews, is that there is just a feature list. This is what it does. If you like this, go ahead. This will be for you. If you don't, you can make your own decisions. I mean,
And people tend to ask me for like my rankings. One of my yearly popular things is like my top five lists.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't tend to make a top five like best of list.
Mm.
What I tend to do is do lists like, I'm gonna probably do a list this year of like the top five games that you might have overlooked. Mm. You know what I mean? Like top five games that might be underrepresented being played right now, or top five titles that came and went in 2020 that you might not notice because of COVID or whatever.
Yeah.
Like I'll do that kind of thing. I'm not going to say these are the best games that everyone should be playing. Although that would, again, the YouTube metrics would love that. I'd probably make more money if I did that, but I'm not going to do that because that's not, I hate that content. It's nothing I would watch. Mm. And that to me feels like the cheapening of my opinion. Like that to me feels like me stating an opinion I don't really believe, because I think it's going to make me some money on YouTube.
Yeah, but I was sort of wondering, where do you see sort of the indie self-publishing game scene going? Sort of, to that topic. Sort of, what are some trends? I mean, skirmish games, sure. Solo gaming due to COVID, sure. Those are sort of there, but do you see anything new sort of forming? I mean, we have Blast 19 with some smaller self-published games.
And Blaster is more like a playground of publications for guys who are in that like medium to large size indie game designer sort of like sphere that I'm in. Yeah. And we don't the thing with Blaster is we have no idea what we're doing. So like we're making a product that we're intentionally not trying to give a framework to, right? Yeah. Because we don't want that to limit our creativity and stuff. But as for like just the indie game market in general, I honestly think that I'm gonna be as surprised as you are, because someone smarter and more talented than me is gonna come along and do something cool, and I'm also gonna go, oh, look at how cool that is. I think that one of the things we've seen over COVID is more incorporation of some sort of like automated stuff, like Tabletop Simulator and stuff like that, where there's a level of like sort of like support for online play and stuff. You might see more people like sort of like lean into that. I definitely think you're gonna see more role-playing stuff get incorporated with the explosion of D&D. I think you're gonna see more of that like legacy element to gaming start to dive in. Because even the current Warband skirmish games, they are less character driven and more faction driven still.
If you look at
Frostgrave, even all the schools of magic are factions, right? They're a way of giving yourself an army compositions to a game.
Yeah.
And they're not so character driven. This is not test the same way. There's all factions. There's a faction list for this faction and that faction. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of micro war games versus being more of a role-playing element. So I think maybe we'll see more of that come in too.
Mm, yeah.
But I don't know. I think the best part of it was that I hope there's enough people in it now and that it's becoming a larger pond so that I get just as surprised as you are, because people way smarter than me start coming up with awesome ideas and I get to enjoy it as much as you do.
Yeah, because I've been in the hobby just as long as you. Maybe you've been in slightly longer than me, but I've also sort of noticed that the narrative skirmish games have sort of exploded over the last couple of years, or rather, player base has definitely increased a whole lot. I mean, I remember back in the olden times where, I don't know, let's say Vol, for instance, or Void, or name any game, the player base was dedicated but small.
It was cast offs of 40K.
Yeah,
Every game was the disenfranchised community of Games Workshop's X or Y player base.
Yeah, exactly. And now he's sort of, and because I just thought of this the other day, that I noticed a guy here in Denmark who had never played any miniature games ever, and he started with Frostgrave. Right. And that sort of means, to me, that was sort of a pivotal moment, because then it has sort of made it. It is now its own thing, if you know. Yeah. And it's not the cast off of Warhammer.
It's transition. It's not Mordheim Light. It's transitioning to being its own thing.
Yeah. We had a quick question from the chat. Unless just
cool. I can take one more because I am at the end of my time now.
Well, let's end up with this then. How did you, Owen and Mike end up in the studio? Were you all friends, and was it business involved?
No, I met them through Mini Wargaming. Both of them were former Mini Wargaming contributors that were both doing their own YouTube channels at the time. And the idea of us collecting our resources and having a single studio space was just something that I liked the idea of. I was like, hey, all three of us are making something here, and I have the resources now to make a space that I can't use 24 hours a day. Would you guys like to be part of it? And initially it was like for financial reasons, but I support the studio completely by myself at this point. And now it's more just about camaraderie and just making things. It became a brain trust more than anything else. And Owen and Mike are like constant contributors, and I'm a constant contributor with them, mostly just because we became sort of friends. We just became friends over time, and I didn't know them. I didn't know anything about them initially. They were strangers like everything else, and they just happened to be local to me and also doing their own little YouTube thing. And I thought, hey, three is better than one. Three is not a lonely number. Let's get together and do something. That was it. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a friendly guy, and I invite people to do things. That's basically the simple, not very interesting answer.
It's a good answer though. But I think that was sort of if you don't have any more time, let's just end it at this point. But I'm really happy that you had time to jump in and talk about a lot of things, really.
Yeah,
I don't know, Søren, if you have some closing remarks before we end up the recording.
Nothing but a thank you. Pleased that you wanted to join us and talk Gamma Wolves and GMG. So thanks for that.
Yeah. Well, thanks guys for having me. I really enjoyed it. I feel like this was definitely a conversation with the people that I was talking about earlier that are of that same sort of like-minded sort of like hobby view and journey and stuff like that. So it's you definitely feel like the people that watch GMG.
I think it's this server is pretty much a skirmish game server mostly. Yeah.
Perfect. My people.
Yeah, your kind of people, definitely.
Perfect.
Awesome. Have a
great day, guys.
Yeah. Thanks. Have a nice Sunday.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening in. Yep. And join us later for some more garage talks.